listening to the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals, the junior mining sector, and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Daily Gold Podcast. I got Vince Lancey here with me. You know him from the Gold Fix. Vince is also part of Echo Bay Futures. He's a prominent shit poster on Twitter. Those are his words, not mine. But Vince, there's a couple things we want to get to, and you know we'll try and get through this as quickly as we can.
Sure.
Okay. First, I think before last time we talked, I was talking about the monthly close, the quarterly close, weekly close, blah blah blah. So yeah. As we know, gold cleared convincing monthly breakout in November, also a convincing weekly breakout at the same time. Sunday night, gold's trade, it's gapped up, it's trading over 2100, and then we get this huge reversal, Mr. Slammy, as right. Some like to say. What the F happened then? It's natural for a market to have a little pullback after such a huge move in a short span of time, but that was of the Mr. Slammy variety. That wasn't just a natural pullback. So, what the F happened?
Just on the surface of it, without putting any inferences in there, the gold market was, gold pricing was not reflecting the difference between China and the U.S. And so the Shanghai Exchange was trading at a significantly higher premium again. And I think what happened was you had pent-up demand. You had Chinese, you had a perfect storm for Sunday night. And that's what got us up. And I think it kind of freaked some people out. And by freaked some people out, I mean freaked out people that didn't want gold to grab those kind of headlines. I think it actually freaked out some people in China as well. So what happened, right? You started it off. So we had November 30th. We had the market closing at a new monthly all-time high, which we discussed it last time and you gave me the number, 2009 spot 20, and it closed above that. That was the first thing, right? November 30th. Also around that same time, we got one of those golden crosses where the 50-day moving average crossed above, I think, the 200-day. I'm not sure how that works, but that's what happened there, right? So you had that. So now you have all this macro discretionary money, which, again, we talked about before, that would likely pile in after November 30th. So November 30th, December 1st was Friday, right? We had that nice big up day. That was the discretionary money coming in. My guess is there were people that were panicking and had to buy. Now, I know that in China, there was a physical issue. China was actually backwardated from the physical to the futures because they'd instigated so much domestic retail demand that the refiners were running low. So I think some shorts panicked in China. I at the same time that there was buying coming in, and all this created a perfect storm. And to finally answer your question, I think we don't know, but I think we're going to find out that the Bank of International Settlements, which is the central banker of central banks, was asked to step in to calm things down a little bit. Now, I don't have any proof of that, but I do know that when the market does what it did at those hours, somebody steps in and calms it down. And in fact, all the behavior since that night has been to calm the market down. CME raised margin requirements last week. The buying seemed to stop except for the Powell pivot news item. So I don't know exactly who did what, but Mr. Slammy was summoned. We should probably talk about what that means anyway, or where that came from.
Yeah, that's following up is good. Let's follow up on that. What does Mr. Slammy mean exactly?
Okay. Well,
and where did that term come from?
Everyone, it came from a Twitter mutual friend of mine, Eric. Not sure how to say his last name. It's a Chinese name. It's Yung, Y-E-U-N-G. affectionately known as King Kong. But look, I mean, the background is we all know, no matter what country you're in, that are certain hours of the day and certain price actions bring about some irrational sell orders. Those sell orders happen at the least liquid times on Sunday night, usually, or during the 8 a.m. London gold fix. But they certainly happen, and they certainly happen at the most opportune times for, you know, as we're euphoric, they're plotting their revenge. Anyway, so one of the things that a couple of mutuals and I were doing on Twitter is if I remember correctly, right? I would say, when gold would rally, I would say something like sell gold, meaning I was trying not to jinx it. You know, sell, you know, don't count your chickens before they're hatched is what I would say. And Eric and I had just kind of connected, and then one day he comes in, he goes, well, don't worry, Mr. Slandy's going to be here and he'll take care of everything. And I went, yeah, that's pretty funny. And it caught on, you know, it's a personification of the evil forces that keep our precious gold in place. Mr. Slammy might be a cartoon character out of a comic book, you know, on the Power of Galactus. We don't know who he is, but we do know that if we invoke him, it's like saying, don't be too bullish on gold. It's a way to keep ourselves honest. That's it. So but that's Eric, and his Twitter handle is, I forget what it is. It's King Kong. There's some numbers after it. But if you follow me on Twitter, you'll find him because we interact a lot. But yeah, he invented that, I don't know, about 8 months ago, maybe a year ago. So you have it. It's called him.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Now, moving on from that, let's talk about the big news last week or the end of last week, the Fed pivot. Yeah, everything's great. The Fed has finally pivoted. Mm-hmm. Let's focus more. We'll get to the third thing. We'll get to, you know, the impact on gold specifically. But,
right.
Okay, the Fed pivot, you know, they've been talking tough for a while, and there's a lot of really smart people are saying they're not going to pivot. It's going to be higher for longer. You know, the data, you know, it shows maybe they could probably hold off if they wanted to, you know, for another quarter or two at least. I mean, the economic data is not horrible yet. You know, there's still some inflationary concerns here and there, even though the statistics are coming down. You know, this seems to me, if we're doing the smell test, I mean, this got an election coming up, and these people at the Fed and the Treasury, they probably view a certain guy as an existential threat. You know, not other people have used those words, not me.
Right.
You don't have to be a conspiracy guy to think that
I'm gonna help you out here, Jordan. Can I help you out here?
Please help me out.
I'm gonna say it for you. You don't have to be anti-Trump to be pro-Biden. And that's what's going on. You know, that's the political aspect of it. They think, you know, that this was politically motivated. And, you know, the evidence is, there may not be proof, but there certainly is a lot of evidence.
But even just in a normal, like, not to deviate, but even just a normal, regular political era, they're going to help the incumbent. Like, naturally, they probably do that anyway.
Yes. And
I'm just pointing out, they have even, given their beliefs, they have even more reason to do that this time. You know, not... Well, I guess those are my words, but I would think, you know, because, you know, that a lot of people view, not, you know, my words, but they have used the words, you know, a certain person is an existential threat.
Right.
So wouldn't they be even more political? I'm just saying, like, aren't they even going to be more political this time around? Because it appears that they're making this pivot earlier than, you know, they would have if there was no election coming up.
Well, I mean, okay, that's actually key. They're pivoting earlier than you would think, given, you don't think they'd pivot this early given an election was, if there were no election coming up. And that's the question that opens the can of worms that makes you ask why, you know? So for the last 6 months, we've seen Powell saying, I'm not politically, he's not saying it, but saying, I'm not giving into pressure from the Democrats or from Yellen. Let's just say Yellen, right? It was Yellen, Yellen and Biden, to ease because I need to get inflation under control, period, end of story. And that's not politically motivated. That's me doing the right thing. I mean, that's I'm just, you know, paraphrasing, putting words in his mouth. And then at the last meeting, I'm sorry, after the last meeting, on December 1st, Powell or one of the Fed people says, Powell says it, it would be premature to act or think about rate cuts. That was like a, I'm almost quoting him, to the market. December 13th, essentially paraphrasing again, he says, we're talking about rate cuts. So between December 1st and December 13th, that's kind of a quick turnaround. Now, to put it into the context of what you just brought up, we were raising rates, we were higher for longer, right? And even though the data had gotten better, no doubt about that, the most recent data last week, right before this, was inflation went from 3% to 4%, you know, a little bit of a spike, and other economic indicators looked positive for the economy. He should be even less inclined to ease or pivot. There's nothing data-wise. Remember, they're, what's the word? We're data-centric. We're
data-dependent.
Yeah. We're data-dependent. Well, what happened last week? You're data-dependent. Okay, so now, like, this is me throwing it out. Now he's really contradicting himself. And so the knee-jerk reaction to those that think Powell's going to cave is he caved, right? He caved politically. The knee-jerk reaction of those who think that he's politically driven are that he caved, belatedly, but he caved. Now, the zero hedge crowd, which, you know, I am one, for the most part, trying to say it as normal as I can, is that in the long run, every Fed chair eventually capitulates, period. And you know what? That's right. In the long run, and don't give me Volcker. Don't give me the whole Volcker nonsense. Not that you are, but don't give me the whole Volcker was a Fed. No, he wasn't. Volcker did what he did because he was told to do it by Reagan. There's nothing independent about what Volcker did. He was told to do it. Anyway, I don't want to get off track. So Powell.
But what? Hold on. Sorry to get off. But wasn't it Jimmy Carter who actually he appointed Volcker?
Yep. Well, even yes. Right. In Jimmy Carter appointed Volcker. Volcker was the chair under Carter. In August of 1979, like I have the line in the sand. In August of 1979, Volcker sat in a meeting, in a conference with the Burns, the Fed chair before him. And at that conference, Burns described or explained or prevaricated why he didn't raise rates sooner, right? And when Volcker left that meeting in, I think it was August of 1979, in September or October, he was raising rates. Now, at that point, he had already gotten the blessing from Reagan, who wanted to go the neo-Keynesian route, which is less spending, lower rates. But we had to stop the inflation right then and there. No, Volcker did what he did because he got the go-ahead to do it under the new president. There's just no doubt in my mind about that. You know, he was a little bit lucky. Let's put it that way. He wasn't that independent. Anyway, I'm not anti-Volcker, but I guess what I'm saying is that you know, the zero hedge part of me is like, yeah, everyone gives in. Everyone gives in to the political pressure.
And that was the one time where, I mean, what your point is, basically every time it's always, you know, cut rates. We need to juice the economy. But the inflation was so bad then that it was like, okay, we need to, this is a necessary evil. Like that's what he was told to do.
Yeah, yeah. Plus Reagan.
And because because Reagan was so early in his term, he could withstand that.
Not just withstand it, he could blame the other guy. We're just fixing what the other guy broke. That stuff. Totally. I mean, that's what they say when you get a
He could withstand it, and like his numbers were actually not that great, you know, early on because there was a recession, but he had plenty of time where he was gonna come out well ahead.
Right, right. He was spending his credit early on and he had plenty of time to earn it back. That's right. That's right.
But anyway, I'm sorry to go off track, but that's basically your point is, and to bring it back to the present, that the Fed always, I mean, they do what they're told to do.
Right.
And
right. They're independent unless their philosophy is at odds with the government's. So now to back off the whole Powell gave in and he caved thing just for a minute, I want to just say that. You know, the exercise that I asked myself when this all happened was taking the whole, you know, he caved and he's politically compromised thing out of it. I'm like, why would he do that? Right. So assuming no politics, well, either something's broken that we don't know about. And, you know, there are things on the horizon that could make it valid. So I'll give you an example. The RRP, which is basically a slush fund for the banks. We've been drawing down on that to digest, to spend on new bond issuance. When that goes to zero, bond yields go up, okay, number one. Number two, the BTFP, that whole facility we created to absorb the bad loans by banks, that emergency funding vehicle, that's set to expire in March. If that expires in March, there's going to be something going on there. You know, maybe we're going to need money for that. So that's two monetary things converging in March. And it's possible that there's something behind the scenes that we don't see. Now, I'm not saying there is. I'm saying it's possible. The other thing, again, I'm pulling it away from the politics side. The other thing is it's quite possible that there's someone in Europe who's really, really close to crying uncle again, and we have to bail them out. There is a geopolitical aspect to this, I believe, that needs to be explored. So we raise rates, Ukraine war ends, it helps Europe get back on its feet. I don't know. Powell doesn't seem geopolitically motivated. He seems very domestic right now. But, you know, so after I give him the benefit of the doubt, I go through it all and I go, no, it's still stupid. It still doesn't make sense. I mean, again, it's over my pay grade, but it doesn't make sense. And here's why. Ultimately, I come down to say it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense because for him to spend the better part of a year getting his reputation back, getting the Fed's reputation back on policy by being higher for longer, by being strong, by not caving, to blow it in one day and say, you know what, we're going to lower rates, you know, or even though he didn't lower the rates, he said he's, you know, we're going to do that, or we're looking to do that. For him to do that is risks confusing the markets communication-wise, right? I mean, it's like, you know, higher for longer, higher for longer, higher for longer, psych, and then the markets, you know, like go up. But then the next day was either him or Williams came out saying, well, now they're talking the other way again. So while they may have their policy ducks in a row now, they certainly have their communication ducks being, you know, slaughtered. I don't know what they're doing. So I think it's fair to say that there's an aspect of this that is politically motivated. And that political motivation, to your point about this not being so much as about, you know, Trump versus Biden, it's more like this. I mean, I could see the rationalization being, if we don't ease rates and we have a recession come on the board while the election is going on, we will look like we're politically motivated to make Biden lose. So I guess it's possible that Powell's like, we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't, and a recession's coming down the pipeline, or pike, however you want to call it, and so we should probably get ahead of it and ease and let the economy work itself out. So, you know, there's a part of me that says this is politically motivated, and there's nothing you're going to make me deny that. However, there could be some other things going on that I don't see.
Well, did, I mean, a lot, not that I, you know, follow all the national news, but you see the tweets and just the kind of, you know, political lackey reporters. They're saying inflation under control, soft landing, you know, they pulled it off, soft landing.
We've only had like two soft landings, I think, in forever.
That's there was one in the like 60s, like mid six, like 66, like 85, you know, mid 80s, mid 90s. So maybe three.
Yeah,
And here's the other, you know, we were talking about the data. Well, here's the data they're not telling us is Biden's poll numbers sinking, like in the last like month. Yeah. I'd have to look just according to some tweets like that. That's the data they're seeing, but not telling us. So that's a piece of data that has shifted, but
how could it not be politically motivated on some level? Even if it's so he can say, you know what,
right,
I saw a problem in the economy. I don't want to influence or hurt Biden. I don't want to help him, but and you know what? Here's the tricky part. Maybe he doesn't ease rates. Maybe he just says he's going to ease rates, or says he's not going to tighten anymore, and that takes the pressure off the markets. But Biden doesn't really benefit.
Well, and even just people knowing and thinking that rates are, everything's forward looking. So they don't even have to raise rates yet for it to juice the economy a little bit.
Right. Which is why I'm going to be very interested in hearing what they keep saying after this. Are they going to come out and keep talking it down, or are they going to kind of play tennis with themselves?
Yeah, I can't tell. There's like a good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
But okay. Anyway, so next thing, which, you know, focusing on gold with respect to this, I know it's confusing for a lot of people, but it really isn't, because Fed easing, yes, in a vacuum, that's good for gold. You know, real interest rates are coming down. However, Fed easing because we're going into a hard landing, really good for gold. Best scenario for gold. Fed easing and we're probably going to have a soft landing, you know, that's not really great for gold. You know, it might be a little bit good for gold, but in that scenario, people are buying stocks. You know, money is going into stocks. Money is going to go into copper. That's a scenario where silver will outperform gold, but that's not a good gold scenario. So think, you know, I see people are just showing what happened the last two or three rate cuts, which of course were super bullish for gold, but you need a hard landing or it's not really bullish for gold.
You know, it's funny that you say that. I mean, I've been thinking about that, meaning from a different point of view, from the Fed point of view. I'm like, you know what? If he pulls off a soft landing and everyone's like, buy everything because he's easing rates. No, when you buy gold, it's because he's easing rates in a panic and he's going to stoke inflation. But if he really has controlled inflation, then maybe gold's not going to benefit. Not to mention, like to your point, like the report that I read recently from T.S. Lombard, and I sent you it's on Goldfix, and I sent you a copy of the chart that matters, I think. They describe it as three different scenarios in gold. One is the hard landing. The hard landing is good for gold. The hard landing is the Fed eases rates because they're a little bit of a panic, and they might overdo it, right? Then there's the higher for longer. If he does nothing, then that's bearish for gold from an inflationary perspective. And then there's the third scenario. And the third scenario is a soft landing. The soft landing is everything goes up, but stocks outperform gold. And I think we might have just gotten a preview of that based on how the markets reacted on Wednesday through Friday last week. You know, gold did well. Stocks did better. You know, gold didn't make new all-time highs after making new all-time highs. I think the Mr. Slammy concept is out there. But I believe it might be warranted right now to keep a little gold. Might not be such a hard thing to do, given the fact that inflation is allegedly on the way to 2%. If you look 6 months out, the path is 2%. And the economy hasn't stalled yet. So I think we've been spoiled, right? Real rates are positive, right? Real rates are positive, and gold has done well. And, you know, gold has done well because there's all these different reasons people are buying gold right now. It's not just a monolith. It's not just like inflation. It's like, no, it's inflation. It's war. It's geopolitics. It's remonetization. It's all these reasons to buy gold. Well, if there are three or four legs in that table to buy gold, one of those four legs, the Fed easing, that leg isn't really that good of a leg anymore. Because if there's low inflation, then you know that's a leg being kicked out from the table. And it's quite possible that even though that I call this buy season and allocations come in to buy gold between November and January, it's quite possible that we've seen the high for the next 6 months. You know, I'm not bearish and I'm not short, but I'm not speculatively long right now. And I missed the last, you know, $20, you know, and I missed the highs, but that's okay because who got to sell on the highs except people that traded at night? Anyway, so I'm kind of in your camp, thinking that a soft landing is not what we want. A soft landing means people like the Fed again. The Fed's doing their job. Why are we buying gold? You know, let's buy some silver, you know, because it's economic. Let's buy some copper. Gold, oh, we don't care about that, you know. So we would need another war, you know. Anyway, I kind of agree with you.
Yeah, so I think that's something important to watch. I mean, moving forward, how are, you know, stock market against gold, also commodities against gold? Because if you look at gold against the S&P, I mean, I have to look at history and see, you know, when has gold been at a comparable point where its performance against the stock market has been this, you know, I don't want to say shitty or terrible, but I mean, it hasn't been great. So,
No, it's been great, except for the last 2 weeks. You know, I mean,
no, but I mean, if you're just plotting gold against the S&P, like it's not a good looking chart right now. It doesn't mean it can't turn around, but
right.
I mean, you mentioned the next 6 months, we would need to see at this point, we would need to see the economy deteriorate a little bit more. You know, so then they actually have to cut rates like multiple, they have to press on the accelerator, that's how gold would, you know, suddenly it starts outperforming the stock market, and then the money's going into gold, it's not going into the stocks or copper.
I think that's a really valid point, and you're describing like a post-COVID world. Post-COVID, like, you know, something breaks that the Fed has to fix, they're not going to ease 25 basis points, they're going to ease 2%. Everything will go up if that happens. But in this instance, because they're just printing money and sending it to everyone, stocks are probably not going to do as well as they do against gold historically. Gold will do better. It's the Fed easing gradually because we're not in a crisis that makes gold underperform. And I think we are shaping up for that sort of a situation going forward. So, you know, if you're bullish gold because of inflation, then, or if you're bullish gold because you think the Fed's going to ease, then you want something to break. That's what you want right now. You know, I want the commercial real estate market to crack. And it's not going to happen if they're easing money, if they're easing rates again. It's the election.
Yeah. And, but also with respect to the stock market, you know, typically, I mean, historically, I know things are out of whack in the last, you know, decade or so. The market actually goes up when they're hiking rates. I mean, that's the it's counterintuitive, right? But the market actually, most of the time, it goes up when they're hiking rates, and then they have to start cutting because things are basically starting to crack.
Right. And, right. When you say the market, you mean the stock market right here.
Yeah.
Right?
The stock market. Right.
No, absolutely. The market will continue to rally as rate hikes begin because the market has been rallying because the market has been reacting to easy money. So it's kind of like the market is the horses, you know, and the Fed's going, whoa, pulling on the reins, but they don't stop right away, you know, and the last few hikes are supposed to be the end of the rally.
Yeah, but even though this is not generally good for gold, the market in the next month or 3 months, whatever, the market could get really ahead of itself. Like if the market does a kind of a melt up or a mini melt up and it gets ahead of itself before the Fed cuts, I mean, then that could be setting up for, the scenario that we're talking about where,
oh yeah,
where you see the market is discounting an easier Fed and it kind of gets over bullish like it usually does going into a significant top. Like if you have that, but the economic data, I mean, there's starting to see like a few more cracks under the surface. If you have that and gold is just kind of sitting there, not doing a lot. I mean, it sounds bad for gold, but you know, then if the market makes a top and then, you know, you get the steepening of the yield curve and you get more recession signals, you know, then you're going to get the market cracking and then gold will bottom and really start zooming higher. I mean, I'm not well, trying to say I think that's a scenario we also have to keep in mind where you do get kind of a mini melt up in the stock market.
Right.
Like where the market gets too exuberant because it's like, oh yeah, soft landing. You know, now the Fed's going to be cutting rates. That, I mean, that to me could set up, early next year. I mean,
euphoria. I agree with you.
The sentiment goes overboard. And so you have that, and that's that setup where you have to look for where when the Fed actually starts, you know, the market's going to peak actually when the Fed starts cutting.
Right.
And so who knows? I mean, that could still happen. Like, maybe the Fed holds off from cut. You know, they're able to be tough for 4 or 5 months and they hold off. But then when, you know, things start cracking, they're forced to actually cut, you know, when the S&P is, what's it at, you know, that 5,500 or something like that. Right. Then it's not, you know, then it's a counterintuitive thing again, where it's actually not bullish that they're cutting.
I think if you're a quant or you're a regression trader, you would go back and you would say, show me times in the last 50 years where the market expected a 50 point discount or rate cut and it got a 25 point rate cut. Show me where, and you can, that's quantifiable. You look at the short term interest rate markets and you find that out and you say, okay, you know, like a good macro analyst, like a Hartnett will be like, all right, the market is too high for the expectations. Well, what are the expectations? Well, the Fed's going to cut. Well, how much are they going to cut? 20. I mean, you got to do the math, right? It's 25 basis points. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the Fed didn't say they were going to cut. What happened was, if you look at the dot plot, the Fed's opinion, which changes all the time, right? It's a fluid thing. The crazy thing about it is, it went from, you know, one or two cuts in 2024 and to like six cuts in 2025. And what they did was their opinions collectively pulled one of the 2025 cuts forward into 2024. So whatever happens, we're paying for 2024 in 2025. That's what's going to happen. So if we get the concept that you're talking about, a melt up in anticipation of a Fed that eases, and they either don't ease or ease in a more disappointed fashion, then yeah, you're setting up for a crash from higher highs. Though that's how they do it. They set it up from higher highs, and they're happy with that anyway. So,
all right. Any final words on anything? I mean, anything we forgot to cover? That's
no. Before, just, you want to? We can keep talking forever.
Yeah, we could. We could.
I want to revisit the technical stuff with you. Is there anything, last time we talked, you explained quite well to me the cup and handle, how the fact that it was leaning the right side of the cup, you know, closer to the handle was higher. And that made you feel very comfortable with this as a cup and handle. Is there anything changing that would make you less bullish on that cup and handle, aside from all the stuff we're talking about? Is there anything technically that makes you less bullish?
No.
On the cup and handle.
There was the S&P. I mean, it wasn't a perfect cup and handle, but the S&P and Dow from 1937 to 19. I mean, they had it took 13 years for the entire pattern.
Right.
Not the cup was 9 years, and then the handle was actually 4 years. So, right. You know, we're a month or two away from 3.5 years into the handle. So, no, I, you know, I just, I, if it's to me, you know, realistic worst case scenario is it just continues consolidating and frustrating.
I'm just updating my database. I'm happy to hear that. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it keeps, you know, it's not like it's going to go to 1600. It just, you know, it goes sideways. It keeps frustrating people for another year. But I think, you know, whether it's going to be a couple months or a year or 18 months, I very confident it's going to break out.
Okay, good, good.
I kind of align that with the economy where we know that at some point a recession and downturn is coming, and you know, that would be the worst case for gold. Realistically, worst case is, you know, maybe we don't have a recession this coming year. You know, maybe it's after the election. You know, maybe it's 2025. But the pattern itself, I mean, it's perfectly fine. But yeah, it's taking a little longer to break out than I expected. But you know, there's nothing to worry about there. I mean, I think we talked about, you know, the key levels at 2000. That's one thing to watch the end of this year, you know, the end of this month. You're going to have the monthly close, the weekly close, but also the quarterly close. I mean, the yearly close too. Yearly resistance is 1900, but we're going to close above that for sure.
Knock on wood, right? Exactly.
Yeah, knock on wood. But the net, I mean, Mr. Slammy, I mean, he'll have to really earn his money for that, you know, for that not to happen. But the focus for me end of this month would be the quarterly close.
Okay.
And so quarterly resistance is, you know, it's in the high 19, but we'll just make it 2000 just to make it clean. So that's one thing. I'd like to see a close at the end of the month of, you know, 2040, 2050. You know, I think that would be a good sign because you would have a new quarterly all-time high.
Right.
And that would also be the second consecutive month where you closed well above, you know, 2000, 2009, the monthly resistance.
And then we could say 2000 is no longer resistance. It's support.
Right. So, yeah, I think that, yeah, how it acts in the next couple weeks, how it closes this month, it would be a good sign, I think, to hold the levels where it's at now.
So just thinking from so December 31st matters, not because, I mean, not saying it doesn't, not so much because it's a yearly close all-time high, because, you know, we're well above that. It's because it's a quarterly close, and it would be the second month in a quarterly close all-time high, and it would be a monthly close, a quarterly close all-time high after a previous quarterly close, I think, right?
No, I don't think we've made a new quarterly.
No, it was November. The November close.
November, right. It would offer more confirmation of the monthly breakout because it would be the second consecutive all-time high close, or at least above the previous resistance. And it would be, for the first time, a new quarterly, you know, a fresh, that's what some technicians say, fresh new quarterly all-time high if it closes above 2000.
Right. Right. Okay.
It's got to be convincing though. You know, a close at like 2007 or 2014, it's like, yeah, that's not really, you know, I'd probably want to see like 2030 minimum.
Right. And to your point, macro discretionary funds, the guys that bought after November 30th, that's what makes them buy. They're thinking what you're thinking. Macro discretionary is not that CTA momentum type. That's the guys with a lot of money that say, yeah, gold, I don't care about it. Just tell me if it has an all-time high close. It did. Gold, I don't care about it. Tell me if it has a monthly close. It did. Oh, really? Fuck. Let's just buy some. Well, let's see what the quarterly all-time high close is. Well, boom, that happens. All the people that are on the fence are going to start stepping in. That's basically it. So I agree with
you. And at the same time, it would be a yearly. It would be significantly because the year, but to close the year above 2000, I mean, that would also be significant.
Right. No, exactly. Right. A yearly close is a given all-time high, but it loses its luster unless it's a quarterly all-time high close, in my opinion. Yeah.
No, yeah.
Which puts us at 2000. Agree. All right, cool. Sounds good.
All right. Great work, Vince. Gold fixed. Tell those who are still listening at this point, we thank you so much. Goldfix, tell our listeners how they could go and subscribe.
Yeah, sure. There's a link that I've created for daily gold listeners. I almost said the Daily Show. Oh my God, the Daily Gold Show. Listeners and viewers, and it's 30% off for life. And I'll give that link to you. What the Gold Fix is a combination of event-driven news about gold, high-level professional bank research by myself and third-party issuers, namely banks, and analysis of geopolitical events, as well as macroeconomic events like inflation that drive the gold market. And you can sign up for free, or you can sign up for an annual subscription. But I'll send a link to Jordan for that. But yeah, come and join us.
Yeah, it's great. Everyone out there, you should definitely subscribe. And Vince, if people want to follow your shit postings on Twitter, right. you want to give that out? Or
yeah, you know, I can't go full corporate. Like, I wanted to, like, you know, have my Twitter account be matched with my, you know, Gold Fix thing. And that, the last time I did that, the account got banned. And so I have a new account, Soren the K, S-O-R-E-N-T-H-E-K. And it'll come up as VBL's ghost. Anyway, you're going to get some good gold stuff on there. You're also going to get some, you know, you're going to get a lot of shit posting. But, you know, I don't do politics, but I will make fun of financial figures. So there you go. It's financial shit posting. That's it.
Well, there's a lot of material there. Vince, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And how about next time we do this, first week of January or so, to see where the market's at after all these important closes?
Yes, we could. Look, if gold is lower, if gold is below 1900, we can do it from you know, the Suicide Watch Bellevue Clinic. And if gold's over 2000, we can do it from like the Cayman Islands or something, you know?
Yeah. You know, if Mr. Slammy reappears multiple times, we're probably going to need somebody to do some wellness checks.
That's right. That's right. All right, man. Thank you for having me on, Jordan. I really appreciate it. And always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for tuning into the Daily Gold Podcast. For more interviews, editorials, and analysis, log on to thedailygold.com. And for premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.